There we go.
Like to welcome everyone back for the first meeting of the British Studies Seminar in the fall semester. This is a great turnout. We would like to welcome people who have not been able to come recently, Helena Woodard, among others. We could name a few others, but we're glad to have Helena. And we're especially glad that James D. has agreed to make another appearance. Last year, he spoke on the question of color, black and white and in between, in antiquity. And I was unable to come to the lecture. I was out of town, but I understand that there was thunderous applause. And so he's back by acclamation. And he's going to talk to us today about the evolution of the concept of humanities. Now, I don't know, but this has ramifications for the ongoing debate. C.P. Snow, the two cultures, whether scientists and humanists can actually sit down at the same table, recognize each other as human beings, and exchange ideas. C.P. Snow's idea in the first place was that a complaint that Oxford and Cambridge were spending too much money on the humanities and not enough on the sciences. At the University of Texas, as Steve Weinberg can affirm, all of the money seems to go to the sciences rather than the humanities.
We're never
gonna get it back. James, we're very glad to welcome you back.
All right, is this audible? Hang on, relentless rapid fire delivery is about to occur. I'm going to pass around several things. First, I'd like to put something up on the screen and stand in the way of it. But in order to let you have a print copy of it, here is from Antiques Roadshow website. Let me see if I can get out of the way. If you can read that, your eyes are too good. That's why I did this. I'd like to begin by thanking Professor Lewis for granting a second opportunity to address this remarkable institution. He described the fall semester leadoff role as a position of honor. From your standpoint, it may be an ordeal to get through as fast as possible. Many academic talks are a leisurely ramble through a pleasant countryside, whereas mine last fall was more like a forced march double time through enemy territory. I do have a request, though I know it will be ignored. This paper, like its predecessor, comes with a handout, a terrifying 10 pages, which I think bids fair to be a world record, and I will try to cover it all. The only way it can surpass last year's talk, which had the potential for consequentiality. I ask you not to look ahead and get distracted. People like Ray Kurzweil talk about the singularity when humans and computers merge. We'll know that the digital apocalypse is upon us when cyberhumans come along that yield to temptation and impishly ignore my request, as some of you first edition humans are about to do. Outline across the top and left margin Roman numbers for structuring the talk. Number one, preliminary. Our metaphorical journey has a chronological linear path, except that, in folkloric fashion, we'll end up back where we started. Our gateway into this quasi-labyrinthine world appeared serendipitously last year in a rerun of Antiques Roadshow. Can we play the tape, the 20 seconds?
Paper written by J.R.R. Tolkien, and it's written, you can barely see it here, but it's from Oxford, where he's teaching. It's 1857, and when I saw a distinctive handwriting right away, I said, it's Tolkien. It was almost like a medieval-looking hand, a very kind of a
telegraph. They're right up there. All right, that's Antiques Roadshow 2 years ago, the other Charleston in West Virginia. What's more British than a letter from Oxford? It's dated 9 June 1957 and written by that fellow named J.R.R. Tolkien. As a result of this correspondence, Marquette University in Wisconsin purchased and still owns the manuscripts of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. They paid the author a pitiful £1,500 for both, about $5,000, each worth millions today, which is what the appraiser goes on to say about the manuscripts. What caught my eye is the phrase that you now should have in front of you. He puts quotation marks around the word humanities in that sentence. Professors of the humanities are not provided secretarial assistance in this institution, Oxford University, and I certainly cannot afford one of my own. So why would Professor Tolkien, who knew as much as anyone about the history of English, do such a thing? It's apparently an unpublished letter. In the 400 pages of published letters, the word humanities, plural, does not occur. Our quest, then, is to find a solution for this puzzle. The first step takes us back to the Middle Roman Empire. The second requires a much larger leap into the past, then forward in time. Step one, the locus classicus for Latin humanitas is in the antiquarian Aulus Gellius's Noctes Atticae, about 180 CE, letter B on your handout. Those who created Latin words and used them properly did not want humanitas to mean what the common people think, which is called philanthropia by the Greeks, and signifies a certain undiscriminating generosity and benevolence toward all humans. Rather, they labeled as humanitas what the Greeks call paideia, which we call education and instruction in the good arts, bonae artes. People who desire and strive for that are humanissimi above everyone else. A concern for and a study of this knowledge, scientia, has been given to the human being alone, uni omni, out of all living creatures, and therefore is called humanitas. Gellius goes on to give Marcus Terentius Varro and Marcus Tullius Cicero as prime examples. Quoting Varro, the name of Praxiteles, the legendary sculptor, is not unknown to anyone who is at least somewhat educated. Paulum modo humaniori. Brief digression number one. Although I've just used Greek, where Gellius has Graecus, for the rest of this paper, I'm going to honor the ancients by using Hellenes and Hellenic, since they are the only words the Hellenes applied to themselves. This is a one-person campaign to stop people from saying Greek and Greece. End of digression one. Gellius exhibits unabashed elitism, contrasting the common people, Latin vulgus, and the better educated who use words properly, Latin adverb probe, and are above everyone else, foreshadowing the attitude of modern prescriptive grammarians and conservative culture war critics. He uses the Latin comparative humaniori and superlative humanissimi to describe the very few among his fellow citizens who could reach the highest levels of intellectual culture, which he calls scientia, knowledge. Best of all, Gellius virtually contradicts himself, saying that the capacity for higher culture has been given uni omni to the human being alone, which should mean, in principle, all humans, right after asserting that only a tiny subset actually qualify for humanitas. If that tendentious use of the generic humanus doesn't make you uncomfortable, recall a brilliant 20th century aphorism. Everyone here can finish it. All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. Now try, all people are human, but some people are more human than others. The last step in that direction is, of course, lebensunwertes Leben, life unworthy of life, the infamous Nazi phrase. That's an inherent tension that will run right through this paper. Gellius posits two distinct semantic realms for humanitas, philanthropia and paideia. But he ignores its original meaning, abstract noun for the adjective humanus, the quality of just being human, biologically rather than culturally. So now there are three paths. The late New York Yankee philosopher Yogi Berra famously said, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. Our road is not bi, but trifurcated. However, encouraged by that sage advice, we're going to take all three. That is, we'll explore three paths. One, generic biological. Two, philanthropia, benevolence, generosity. And most important for us, paideia, cultural literary education. I've put at letter C a selection of European language words for human, etc., and where appropriate, their opposites marked by an asterisk. This richly resonant semantic cluster arises from our ancestors' recognition of the unity of the human species, which is much older than the high culture of Gellius. 2. Prehistory. Step 2, as you all know, and most appropriately for this talk, scientific terminology since Linnaeus has used the Latin homo, capitalized, and various adjectives, uncapitalized, to identify members of our genus. Brief digression number 2. The character string homo of homo sapiens has nothing to do with the homo of homosexual, which is a modern semi-barbarous hybrid containing the Hellenic adjective homos, same, with Latin adjective sexualis. Also, the NS of sapiens is a Latin singular, the same singular S as in biceps and triceps. This is a level of Latin not understood by the people who did that monument. End of digression 2. It's fortunate that none of our non-sapiens predecessors are around, even if we reportedly do have some of their DNA. Some might say that today's politics shows the persistence of Neanderthal DNA, but I apologize if that's an insult to the Neanderthals. I couldn't resist the opportunity to show you what Homo sapiens used to look like. Handout page 6 is the cover of the preeminent British journal Nature, 12th June 2003. Letter D for reference. With a reconstruction of a Homo sapiens skeleton about 160,000 years BP before present. An almost suspiciously clean-cut, handsome fellow, a young Morgan Freeman, perhaps. And he or some members of his age cohort are ancestors of us all. Yuval Harari's popularizing book Sapiens, Letter D, summarizes current knowledge in paleoanthropology. Now, an English class marker proverb says, a gentleman need not know Latin, but he should at least have forgotten it. In spite of an Oxford DPhil in history, not science or classics, Harari has forgotten his Latin, since he regularly says, sapiens are, as if it were a plural, and no one at HarperCollins knew any better. The genus Homo diverged from our primate kin about 6 or 7 million years ago, so our 200,000-year history is only about a 30th of that span, and just 1/19,000th of the time since life began 3.8 billion years back. People are unreflectively myopic about chronology. Many still believe the universe is less than 10,000 years old. And as was said about George W. Bush, our species has awakened, finds itself on third base, and thinks it hit a triple. As if we came from nowhere yesterday. Your handout has two recent items, letter D, by Franz de Waal at Emory, a leading researcher into the surprisingly humanoid qualities of our extended family, along with an entertaining New Yorker article on humans who, with engaging if naive earnestness, try to become animals, unlearning their human nature, something only humans could think of doing. Our usual idea of human nature rests on a reification of our intellectual faculties. As Yale psychologist Paul Bloom noted in a New York Times op-ed a dozen years ago, letter D again, we are instinctive dualists and believe we are separable from the bodies in which our personhoods are trapped. Modern neuroscience rejects this, arguing that self-awareness is a construct produced instantaneously on the fly by our 100 billion massively interconnected neurons. More remarkably, I can make the decision to wave my hand like this, but experiments by the late Benjamin Libet decades ago, letter D again, controversial but repeatedly confirmed, show that action potential radiates from brain down to fingers about a third of a second before I am aware of making the decision to do this. The recent PBS series Genius, hosted by Stephen Hawking, has a dramatization of Libet's findings. The implications for free will and moral culpability are so alarming that many still can't accept them. Also at letter D are two slightly older but excellent surveys of consciousness research. And a further implication of that research connects with our main theme. You all know the line from Apollo's temple at Delphi, know thyself, Hellenic gnotis auton, which did not mean get in touch with your inner self, California style, but rather know that you are by nature a human, not a god. Modern psychology suggests we can't know ourselves because so much of what each of us is resides below the level of consciousness. The 1735 first edition of Linnaeus's Systema Naturae places humans among the anthropomorphic quadrupeds in four races, letter E. Instead of defining homo by fingers and toes, he just says noscete ipsum, Latin for gnoti se auton, know thyself. The four races are, in highly tendentious order, Europaeus albescens, whitish, Americanus rubescens, reddish, Asiaticus fuscus, darkish, and Africanus nigrescens, blackish. The word sapiens was apparently not added till the 10th edition of 1758. Now, each human body may have 10 trillion cells with our DNA, but in the last decade or so, we've discovered, in and on us, 100 trillion bacterial cells with alien DNA, our microbiota, many of them necessary for us to stay alive, which means that dreams of interstellar space travel and biblical-style bodily resurrection are a lot harder to take seriously. So concepts like being human and human nature have a lot more complexity than was ever imagined in our first 200,000 years. Thus endeth the mini lecture on the science of human nature, but we'll come back to the opposition of science and the humanities. Now, the brighter light of recorded history, classical Hellenic and Roman civilization. 3A, antiquity Hellenic. As letter C shows, the Hellenic word for human being, anthropos, written in linear B as atorokko, is found describing a footstool decorated with a human, a horse, an octopus, and a griffin. So it's clearly path one, generic in meaning. Tom Palaima confirmed for me last spring that this is the only example of pre-Hellenic anthropos. Homo and anthropos are obviously very different, and it's odd that in spite of all the commonalities in the Indo-European family of languages, there is no common Indo-European root for human being. I can say that thanks to a truly remarkable book, Karl Buck's 1949, 1,515-page work, letter C, which I've added gratuitously to the handout just to put it on your radar. In 1988, the U of C Press issued a micrographic paperback, four pages in one, like the reduced OED. It's one of the few books you can open at random and find fascinating stuff on any page, and it's in English. Coming forward, there is an almost accidental Homeric antecedent for path two, philanthropia, letter F. Iliad 6:14, one oxylos is described as philos anthropoisi, a friend to mankind, and thus we might say the first philanthropist. The next line says he was a generous host to all travelers who arrived at his home, that legendary Hellenic hospitality. In 4th century Athens, there was a minor conflict about human nature, path one, between two famous and very different philosophers, Plato and Diogenes the Cynic. Hellenic kynikos meant dog-like, shameless, and Diogenes' behavior shows he earned the epithet living according to nature and doing bodily functions in public. Plato called him Socrates Minomenos, a Socrates gone insane. Letter F from Diogenes Laertius has the only source for this story. When Plato issued the definition, a human being, anthropos, is a living animal with 2 feet and no wings, featherless biped, Diogenes plucked a rooster and brought it into the academy saying, this is Plato's human being. So flat-nailed was added to the definition. Of course, Diogenes was cheating when he removed the feathers. This is just lexical, but another far more important development was taking place at the same time, leading toward path three. Letter G has 6 quotes. I'll save time by not reading them into the record or other quotes coming up. One from Euripides, Socrates' student Aristippus, writers of New Comedy Menander and Philemon around 300 BCE, Aristotle, and anachronistically within the group, Socrates himself. The Euripides quote doesn't have our theme word, but it does have a pattern of syntax and meaning that parallels the next three. Taken together, they offer an early instance of an enlightened or idealistic view of human beings, placing a special value on humanity and, in Aristippus, the potentially civilizing effect of education, precisely the philanthropia and paideia aspects in Gellius hundreds of years later. I left the word anthropismos untranslated. It occurs once in surviving texts, marked 1x on your page. The Standard Greek Dictionary says humanity, which is pretty opaque as a definition. Another example of the ideal-real contrast is Aristotle's remark, letter G, that Sophocles said he portrayed people as they ought to be, whereas Euripides portrayed them as they are in all their unedifying venality. I added Socrates' famous line about the unexamined life because not everyone knows that the last word is anthropoi, not worth living for a human being. Context shows that Socrates meant path one for any human being, although he discovered the hard way that most people don't want to examine their lives. This emergent sense that some people could be better than merely human seems to surface in one of the most familiar and yet misunderstood images from the ancient world. Diogenes the Cynic, carrying a lamp in broad daylight, looking for what? An honest man. But as I discovered preparing for this talk, that's not what the ancient texts say. Letter H has the only source where Diogenes' quest is expressed in two Hellenic words, anthroponzeto, I'm looking for a human being. There is no word corresponding to honest, yet it's now proverbial, and there are no confirmed ancient images of Diogenes with the lamp. Digression number three. There's a Chicago version, having spent a quarter century up there. Diogenes gets dropped off in the loop, puts the lamp down to look up at the big buildings, and when he looks back, it's been stolen. It's the great city of Chicago, but it was never the honest city of Chicago. End of digression three. What did Diogenes mean? The single-sentence story in Diogenes Laertius doesn't come with an explanation. However, it's part of a larger pattern demonstrating the cynic's contempt for most humans. Also at letter H is the story that he shouted, hey, humans, anthropoi, and when a crowd gathered, he swung his staff, his walking stick, at them and said, I called for humans, not garbage. The Hellenic word is katharmata. It's actually related to catharsis, the Aristotelian term, stuff you sweep up and throw away. Another example of that tension between real and ideal. The story at letter I, involving the same Aristippus as at letter G2, offers a more favorable outlook on humans and education. The ambivalent Latin word vestigia ingeniously fuses path one, tracks of humans, not animals, and path three, diagrams, not footprints. The oldest sources are in Latin. The later text from Galen, 2nd century CE, rather chauvinistically says, Hellenes and intelligent men, dropping the tracks image altogether. Clarence Glacken's long book on nature and culture, also at letter I, uses English traces, losing the complexity of tracks. The footprint scene in Robinson Crusoe echoes this in a literal way. Far more resonant and evocative is a scene in Virgil's Aeneid 1, where his hero, shipwrecked on the North African coast, sees Trojan war scenes on a temple and says, there are tears for human affairs and mortal things touch the mind. He expects humane treatment, path two, because the locals are educated enough, path three, to know and sympathize with Trojan refugees. 3b, Antiquity Roman. Ancient Italy was the birthplace of humanitas, that Latin word that encompasses all three paths in a way that, as Gellius said, no Hellenic word does. Scholarly integrity requires that I acknowledge, letter J, two entry points in this area. The late Wolfgang Schadewalt's brief but essential introduction is a tiny part of the largest Festschrift in history, more than 85 volumes like this since 1972 and still going. I've brazenly plagiarized Rudolf Rieck's monograph for my title, the three words in Latin. Brief digression number four, addressed to graduate students and young faculty. 30 years ago, I was unexpectedly invited to be on an NEH fellowship panel and saw the process from the inside. 2 years later, my application on today's topic was turned down, but I knew I should ask for redacted copies of the panelists' reports, which showed that a scaled-down proposal might work, and it did the next year. So if you do apply and aren't initially successful, ask for those reports. I say, even if you win, ask for them. They should be competent, unbiased, and possibly some of the best professional advice you'll ever get. End of digression four. Letter K is one of the most famous lines in Latin literature from 2nd century comic playwright Terence. Homo sum humani nillame alienum puto. I'm a human, I consider nothing human alien to me. It's often treated as a fine expression of humane sympathies until one discovers that in context it's a shameless self-justification from a stereotypical busybody. But the Terentian character is probably twisting a pre-existing sentiment that did display a positive attitude without irony. In the late Republic, the spectacular patrician Julius Caesar uses our theme word in a passage from the Gallic War, letter K, which used to be standard reading for college-bound 10th graders. I was one of them about 85 years ago. He turns path three against itself, saying the Belgians are the strongest tribe in Gaul because they are farthest from the civility and humanitas of the Roman province, the area still called Provence, invoking an already well-established commonplace that civilization and higher culture make men soft and weak. But I think you know who won the Gallic War. The French admire the cartoon character Astérix, but if the Gauls had succeeded, there would be no glorious Latin-based French language for them to speak. The peak of humanitas in the classical period comes with Marcus Tullius Cicero. Over the summer, one classic's internet bulletin board exploded with a discussion of Ciceronian humanitas, more than 40 posts in a matter of a month. And someone noted that Cicero uses the word over 300 times with a special fondness for path three that strongly influenced the Renaissance. I've selected just one passage, letter K again. It invokes the Muses, the Hellenic goddesses of the arts, and it praises the Hellenic mathematical genius Archimedes, showing that Roman path three humanitas was bilingual and bicultural. By a spectacular and maybe not coincidental irony, the author of the previous quote, the tyrant Julius Caesar, was assassinated right about the time Cicero was writing this passage about a tyrant. Cicero was not a fan of Julius Caesar. Now, for medievalists, hands over ears for the next 90 seconds. They get annoyed when someone undervalues their specialty, and I agree important things happened between the fall of Rome and the rise of the Renaissance. But here, conventional wisdom seems right. Medieval Latin dictionaries show that the word humanitas lost the path three higher culture sense, although one fascicle in 2014 of a massive German Mittellateinisches Wörterbuch does have two examples from obscure authors. Theological concerns confined the word almost exclusively to path one, versus divinitas, with some preservation of path two, generosity, because the noun humanitas could be used concretely for food given to the poor. But there is one medieval, really late classical element that shouldn't be omitted, the seven liberal arts. Described in a curious late 5th century work by Martianus Capella, The Marriage of Philology and Mercury. A pair of medieval Latin hexameters, letter L, lists them using abbreviations. All seven have Hellenic names, showing the long intellectual tradition behind them. The artes encompass a greater range than any classical or Renaissance definition of humanitas. Latin ars, translating Hellenic techne, meant a body of knowledge that allows you to do or be something. There was a techne, or ars, for farming, pottery, carpentry, metalworking, any specialized skill. As noted last year, the eleutherioi technai, or liberales artes, were different in being, in the OED's splendid phrase, suitable for persons of superior social station. But they were still bodies of knowledge and theoretically accessible to anyone. And I'll come back to this. Number four, Renaissance plus. Medievalist hands can come off ears now. It's the turn for Renaissance experts to cover up, because I'm going to engage in pure superficiality dealing in a few minutes with four centuries, multiple languages, and hundreds of participants. The plus sign on your handout is not a typo. This section extends through the 18th century. As a metaphor, you might imagine a noble American bald eagle that skims over a wide and deep lake, snatching a fish at the surface and holding it up for all to see, like this. I am being consciously selective, but like the eagle, I don't really know enough about the other fish. I have to acknowledge letter M, an important predecessor for the rest of this paper, the 2014 book Philology by James Turner, Harvard history PhD, who recently retired as Kavanaugh Professor of, appropriately, Humanities at Notre Dame. His 386 text pages and 166 of notes, bibliography, and index chart the development from the Hellenes to the present of a concept closely connected to my topic. His principal theme is stated in the subtitle, How the Various Academic Fields Within the Humanities Emerged from Philologia, which originally embraced them all explicitly or implicitly. I've listed the areas he treats as children of philology, and I've also added Robert Proctor's 1988 book, which Turner doesn't mention, although it focuses on the same sort of academic cultural forgetting. Disconcertingly, Turner admits he has no Sanskrit, not a deal breaker, no Hebrew, not good, no Hellenic, much worse, and is, in his own words, feeble in Latin, really alarming. Ben Johnson said Shakespeare had small Latin and less a Greek, but Will knew more than Professor Turner. To be rude, he's not really qualified to write about classical or Renaissance philologia from a scholarly standpoint. Nevertheless, he does offer, as he says, an unparalleled introduction to this area with abundant archival research in 19th and 20th century materials, conveniently in English. Our resident, Steven Weinberg, I am pleased to see here, recently published an excellent history of science, To Explain the World, letter M. He opens part four with a famously paradoxical statement from historian Stephen Shapin's 1996 book, also letter M. There was no such thing as the scientific revolution, and this is a book about it. There's no debating the reality of the Renaissance, even if there are precursors and problems of definition. The leaders of that great movement were well aware of their departure from the immediate past, which they expressed in several striking images. One sign of the new outlook is a famous remark of a founder of Latin epigraphy, Cyriac of Ancona, not mentioned by Turner. When a local priest, described as ignorant and common, vulgar, the same root as Gellius's Vulgus, asked why he was looking at old inscriptions, he said at letter N, I've learned to raise up the dead from the underworld, mortuos ab inferi suscitare didici, or whatever it sounded like to a Renaissance Italian. He may have been lucky it wasn't regarded as blasphemous, since raising the dead was somebody else's specialty. A recent book title, also letter N, features that phrase to highlight Cyriac's achievement. I've put on your handout, letter N again, a 150-year-old example found by chance of the stereotypical dismissal of the Middle Ages. The phrase at the end, wakened the soundest sleepers, clearly echoes Cyriac's image. Now, Renaissance in French means rebirth, so what was reborn? From my classicist, that is, outsider's perspective, two features are central for this talk. The first, a reversion to classical texts in reading and classical standards in writing, Latin prose and verse, a change which a medievalist once described as the cold-blooded murder of a living language. Second was the dramatic revival of the Hellenic language in Central and Western Europe, starting in Northern Italy in the very late 1300s. One small step in that Renaissance restoration was the reemergence of an ancient but rare phrase, studia humanitatis, studies in humanitas. Professor Turner says in his second footnote, without source, quote, the specific phrase studia humanitatis seems to have been coined by the Italian humanist Coluccio Salutato in 1374. Now, the name was Salutati, not Salutato. And a little more digging would have uncovered an earlier instance. At letter O, Ronald Witt's book on Coluccio, not mentioned by Turner, cites letters 2-18 dated securely to 30 September 1369, a consolatory letter on the death of the addressee's father. Because Witt doesn't quote the passage, I thought I should provide the words that document the birth of the historic phrase at the dawn of the Renaissance. Note the retrospective distancing. It's the study of something not present in their world, that is, in the past three sense. also at letter O is a passage from Coluccio with the interestingly complicated word scientificus, which was invented in Latin almost 250 years earlier. The scienti element here doesn't refer to science in the modern sense, but to its root meaning of knowledge, as it did in Gellius. A textbook example of the gap between late medieval and early Renaissance is the case of Francesco Petrarca, 1304 to 1374, described in older Britannica editions as the first humanist. His transitional status is crystallized in one fact. He was given a manuscript of the Iliad, but he couldn't read it because no one in Italy could teach him Hellenic. His contemporary, Giovanni Boccaccio, became the first serious student of Hellenic in the West, boasting of his primacy in the 15th book of his massive genealogy of the pagan gods. In the passage at letter P, he defends himself against criticism for using Hellenic words in a Latin treatise intended for an Italian readership. At the end, after a flurry of egotism, it's almost charming to see candor about his failure to reach full command. It does take a while to learn Hellenic. From 1396 to 1400, the Constantinople-based teacher Emmanuel Chrysoloras taught a number of young men Hellenic in Florence. Several of them, including Leonardo Bruni, said that no Italian had understood the language for 700 years. A powerful indicator of the long-range cultural effects of the collapse of the Roman Empire and the schism between Eastern and Western Christianity. 700 years from today was the year 1316. That's the length of this cultural vacuum. Scholars in the Middle Ages did not lose knowledge of all the classical canonical texts, but because the ancient authors were constantly in complex dialogue with their Hellenic predecessors, mere Latin translations, whether of Homer or Aristotle or the lyric and tragic poets, were a poor substitute for originals. The Catholic Church and most secular entities could enforce Latin for centuries, but there could be no full rebirth of classical humanitas until Hellenic was restored to its place as equal or superior to Latin, the bicultural aspect mentioned earlier. The scholar enthusiasts of the Renaissance are commonly called humanists, a word that clearly belongs to our Homo Humanus Humanitas group. But there's something odd about it. As you can see from the chart back at letter C, there was no classical antecedent for the form, humanista. It's another semi-barbarous hybrid mixing Latin human and Latinized Hellenic suffix ista. The 70-year-old classical article by Augusto Campana, letter P, shows that humanista in Italian, not Latin, originally referred to a public or private teacher of classical literature, the chair of humanitas or humanita, a little less grandiose than you might expect. The earliest occurrence so far found is in a letter by the rector of the academy in Pisa, securely dated to December 1490, much later than the recreation of the Studia Humanitatis. When early Renaissance scholars were rescuing old Latin manuscripts, they saw lettering quite different from the current style, broadly called Gothic. They thought it was the handwriting of the ancient Romans. It was actually Carolingian, roughly 9th century. Their imitation is now called humanistic script. Handout page 7, item 1, shows a more or less typical piece of Gothic, followed at number 2 by the older Carolingian and newer Renaissance humanistic. Gothic is an ancestor of German Fraktur, also at the right at the top of number 1, and you can see why it seemed less attractive. Try reading Fraktur for 10 or 15 minutes, and you'll feel noticeably crabbier and crankier. Imagine the cumulative effect of it, of centuries of it, on the German national psyche. That's the larger importance of humanistic script, source of our modern lowercase Roman fonts, a less heralded but truly universal gift from the Renaissance, which even the Germans have adopted in recent times. Turner's book doesn't mention an entertaining fact, the existence in Scottish universities for 4 centuries of the title Professor of Humanity, singular. As you can see from the first Britannica entry, page 7, number 5, professors of humanity taught Latin language and literature and were called humanists, echoing that original meaning. though none of the principal Scottish universities today has such a title. The Edinburgh website says the teaching of humanity began at the founding about 1582, but the post was abandoned due to funding restrictions in 1982. Surely a casualty of Thatcherism. What about Shakespeare, he of small Latin? Marvin Spevak's one-volume concordance has at most 11 occurrences of humanity, not one of them in the past three sense. 9 instances of humane and 2 of humanely focus on path 2, kindness. One can find passages where characters express mild or strong rejection of the formal book learning of Elizabethan England. What Will himself thought can only be guessed. But Ben Jonson's famous remark, implying that even a playwright, a class not to be confused with scholars, should know Latin and Hellenic, shows how far Europe had come since no one in Italy had known Hellenic for 700 years. T.W. Baldwin's 72-year-old, 1,500-page study, letter Q, argues that Shakespeare's presumed grammar school education was sufficient to give what he needed, not what others might prefer. Baldwin notes that Will hardly mentions Cicero, the chief source of classical humanitas, but that in the seriously playful Ovid he found, quoting, something of his inmost self. Brief digression number 4. A detour for the strangest use of a humanitas-based word I've ever seen. There's a passage from Rabelais' Gargantua and Pantagruel that comes from a 16th century dictionary of French. And there's a, if you can read it, you can see what it is. Ma petite humanité is a euphemism for male genitalia. There is a modern use of manhood that resembles this, but this whole subject is too crude for polite company. End of digression 4, quickly. After the brilliant burst of energy at the restoration of the Studia Humanitatis and the return of Hellenic, the Humanitas word family went quiet for a time. As evidence, I offer the entries at handout page 7, 4 to 6, taken from Samuel Johnson's famous 1755 dictionary, the first Britannica, 1768 to 71, and Noah Webster's American Language Dictionary of 1828, which show no significant expansion of meaning. Dictionaries can't always be taken for granted. That chart at letter C has the first OED entry for literae humaniores from Lord Chesterfield, 1747. But that's only in an English language context, as Latin it had existed for centuries. And it's still used for Balliol Classics Department, classics, parentheses, literae humaniores. So it does survive sort of at Oxford. I've already mentioned Shakespeare's apparent disinterest in the fancier trappings of classical learning. On this side of the Atlantic, anti-classical feelings could be more openly expressed in the late 18th century. Letter Q has 2 bits from Declaration of Independence signer Benjamin Rush, M.D., the first quoted in Douglas Sloan's book, the second an enjoyable discovery I made by looking up the original online. Writers like Ovid were objectionable to Dr. Rush, but powerfully appealing to Shakespeare. I'll come back to that subversive aspect of the humanities in a moment. 5, 19th century. A powerful new force was emerging at the end of the 18th century. The field we now call science, which closely linked to technology, challenged the long educational and cultural predominance of what could be called philologia, or liberal arts, or classics, or eventually the humanities. From here to the end, I'll be jumping back and forth within the humanitas word family, academic structures, and the growing sciences-humanities conflict. At the beginning of the 19th century, the terms humanity, and when used at all, plural humanities, retained their traditional meanings and were closely allied to Professor Turner's keyword, philology. By the end of the century, philologia had given birth to a wide range of academic and intellectual fields, and the plural form humanities had come to embrace almost all of them. In researching this development, I've been unable to find any contemporary commenting on this shift, which from a classicist's perspective seems pretty drastic. I don't have a lot of confidence in Google's Ngram viewer online, but here is the chart for the humanities plural since 1800, showing it goes almost nowhere until actually about 1940s, and then reaching this peak here in the 1970s. Now, that's just a map of frequency, not semantic change. and it's subject to all the problems of searches of that sort. But there was one important lexical development at the beginning of the 19th century, filling a glaring gap in the letter C chart. The pair humanist-humanistic should have had a parallel form, humanism. No such word existed in any European language until 1808, and it was created not in Latin-based Romance languages, but in German as Humanismus, in a book about educational theory, letter R. The example of Fraktur on your handout 7 is actually that title page, the first occurrence of the word. Once invented, it took on a life of its own, adopted in every European language to name a central feature of the Renaissance, a surprising semantic shift because it should have been created for that purpose originally. Also at letter R is a substantial article by Vito Giustiniani, who deals with Marxist humanism and secular humanism, so I leave them out today. Institutional and curricular developments also started early in the 19th century. I grew up about 10 blocks from one of the pioneers, the significantly named Union College in Schenectady, New York. Founded in 1795, it was one of the first American colleges to offer non-classical programs, followed by RPI, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, in nearby Troy, New York, which had chemistry and physics labs in 1824 and started giving engineering degrees in 1835. The establishment countered with the 1828 Yale Report, not mentioned by Turner, which reasserted the centrality of the classical curriculum and, in good aristocratic fashion, rejected the encroachments of practicality and the vulgar mechanical world. You can read about this and much else in Frederick Rudolph's classic but highly enjoyable account, letter R. He cites Samuel Eliot Morrison's statement that the typical Harvard student in the 1790s was an atheist, an enlightenment post-revolutionary glow that didn't last. Moving to the sciences, there's a striking optical illusion called chromostereopsis. Page 8 gives two examples, duplicated in color. Red and yellow, if you see it in sharp focus on the surface, appear above, and blue below. The sharper the focus, the stronger the effect. It's binocular. Close one eye and it's gone. Not everyone sees it in the same way. Some don't see it at all. I put it before you today because the first person to mention it in literature in 1810 was the great German writer Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, letter S, in a 1,400-page treatise called Zur Farbenlehre, on the theory of colors. But the stained glass artist who made the item on your page in 1564 must have seen it, and so also the person who did this recent New Yorker cover. Get a good sharp focus on this, and it's like a 50s comic book with the cellophane glasses. It's electrifying when you do it right. So this is something that has been known for a long time. I added a professional journal article at letter S to show the phenomenon is still under discussion. At first, this seemed like a good example of constructive contact between the humanities and the sciences. And then I found out that the second part of Goethe's treatise, never translated, was an intense polemic against a predecessor who had worked on the theory of light and color, some character named Newton. Goethe thought to the end of his life that Farbenlehre would be his most significant contribution to European culture. Didn't happen. But his was the last age of non-professionally credentialed enthusiasts trying to do scientific work, a time memorably described in Richard Holmes's fascinating book, The Age of Wonder, also letter S. Holmes says, for example, that the astronomer William Herschel, who also composed music and had a foot in each camp, speculated in the 1780s that the nebulae, little clouds he saw, might be island universes, what we call galaxies, at incomprehensible distance. The lexical shift turns up at mid-century. The first OED example of plural humanities in path 3 sense dates from 1855, letter T. The Boston-based Dwight's Journal of Music declared that music was now regarded as one of the, in quotation marks, humanities. In 1886, the eminent English jurist Sir Frederick Pollock uses plural twice, without quotation marks, also letter T. The OED quotes the second passage, but the first shows a broader range with art and music included. In the institutional category, I cite just a few examples at random from Turner of emerging academic fields. 1819, the first modern languages at Harvard, French and Spanish. 1828, English at London. 1838, modern history at Harvard. 1883, the American Modern Language Association. Spilling over into the 20th, 1904, a professor of English at Oxford. 1917, an English tripos at Cambridge. Tensions between the classics-based humanities and the sciences continue to grow. Letter T has a comment from Mark Pattison, rector of Lincoln College, Oxford, originally published in 1875, describing the conquests of science. An especially striking remark when we consider how many more conquests would come in the next generation or two. The fourth passage at T shows an unblushingly triumphalist pro-science view with explicit reference to class prejudice at Yale, talking about rowing and fencing. It comes from a name some of you might recognize, but from a completely different context. Clarence King was a highly respected scientist and the first director of the U.S. Geological Survey. Right when he was drafting this essay, he met and fell in love with a woman named Ada Copeland, an African-American. Since he was white, they couldn't be married, so he told her his name was James Todd and he was a Negro with an invisible one drop. They were married for 13 years, and he told her the truth only in a deathbed letter in 1901. King, like Dr. Thomas Theodore McKinney in last year's talk, argued for race amalgamation through total intermarriage, yet he destroyed all evidence of his own intermarriage. Martha Sandweiss's book tells this bizarre story of love amid American racism. Number six, the humanities. Back to lexical level. At the brink of the 20th century, June 1899, the OED issued its entry for humanity, letter U. I've selected only the past 3 cents where the 19th century expansion is fully accepted. Note that final phrase, an ideographic rather than nomothetic character. In lexicography, the definition shouldn't be more incomprehensible than the word itself. The fields specified are quite close to the 1965 definition of the NEH on handout 9. I've reproduced both the original act and its 2014 version with almost twice as much text. You can infer a lot about America's cultural history in that half century by studying the editions. In the early 20th century, you find quotation marks again, letter U, from another Englishman, Viscount Bryce, putting them around humanistic in 1911. He was presumably marking its new use as the adjective corresponding to the new plural, humanities, perhaps taking it as an Americanism. I focus mostly on path three, the one that leads to the humanities, but path one, human beings in general, has been prominent in response to the last century's horrors. In the 1937 Hindenburg tragedy, an announcer famously cries out, "Oh, the humanity." In World War II, Winston Churchill was called the leader of humanity. Jonathan Glover's somber account, letter U, uses the word as primary title. Just last Sunday, Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale, letter U again, wrote that his father, quote, would reprimand me for taking the Holocaust to be about me or my family. The Holocaust was about humanity. It was about what we are capable of doing to one another. Even the adjective noun human can be forcefully applied. Harold Bloom's provocative claim that Shakespeare invented the human, which would come as a surprise to his predecessors, and Nicholson Baker's controversial volume on World War II. But the most striking use of the plain word, handout 10, is almost completely unknown both here and in Italy, so I take this opportunity to bring it to your attention, with apologies for a crudely literal translation. It's better in the original. Written by Benedetto Croce, the foremost Italian intellectual of his era, it's a ringing denunciation of the atrocities the Nazis committed everywhere they went, calling them at the end the present atrocious enemy of humanity. I know this text only from the fascinating book of Armando Petrucci, a highly respected paleographer. The event is called the massacre, strage, of Caiazzo near Naples. And the date and number of the victims is secure, but the story is more complicated than Croce's highly dramatized account of villagers murdered for mere insolence, telling a German officer that the enemy was his own men. In fact, 7 men were shot first, then 15 women and children. Carolyn Moorhead, who was here last year and is researching the resistance in northern Italy, told me she was unaware of this episode, and it's not mentioned in Claudio Pavone's 800-page narrative of the resistance, A Civil War. Minor uncertainties aside, however, it's still the most memorable text in this talk. There's a striking case where humanities is not used. Scientist and novelist C.P. Snow published The Two Cultures, already mentioned, in 1959, letter V. I was sure he contrasted sciences and humanities, only to find on rereading that he never uses the latter phrase. It's literary intellectuals, and he pungently notes that they sometimes drop the word literary, implying they're the only intellectuals. This is relevant for our quest, since Snow was both a compatriot and contemporary of Tolkien. In the institutional and curricular area, the 20th century saw an unparalleled proliferation of colleges and universities in this country, often centered on a college of arts and sciences, which UT used to have. Old-timers may remember this, which I came across again at random. This is the American Statesman, 1970, Sunday, July 26th, pictures of Stanley Ross, Charles Amader, and John Silber. And it's a story about the firing, abrupt and unexpected by some, of the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, John Silber. Now, there was no hint of the actual architect, Frank Irwin, the chairman of the Regents, and no hint that the college would soon split apart. The present configuration, a College of Liberal Arts, COLA, encompassing the modern humanities and social sciences, and a College of Natural Sciences, may now seem uncontroversial, 46 years ago. But Latin ars and Hellenic techne meant body of knowledge, and so did Latin scientia. The apparent opposition of arts and sciences that most people see when they see the two words has little historical basis. After all, arithmetic, geometry, and astronomy were among the original liberales artes. So I offer two mutually contradictory fantasies to underline the arbitrariness of these terms. One, the liberal arts college declares that as with Ars Astronomica, there is also an Ars Physica and Chemica and Geologica and Biologica. So it will absorb the natural sciences college, restoring the pre-1970 unity. Number two, the natural sciences college contrarily declares that their purview is all things natural, which necessarily includes human life, society, and behavior, and thus it will absorb the liberal arts college. Imagine two pythons trying to swallow each other. Even the humanities could play this game, arguing that natural and social sciences are human activities and thus subject to incorporation. Nonsense aside, someone should examine how Latin scientia carved out its own semantic territory when ours was already in place. On top of the disciplinary division between humanities and sciences, a deplorable gap opened up based on class distinctions, as seen in the Yale report and Clarence King's comment at letter T, faintly echoing elements already in Gellius. There's an especially outrageous bit from Evelyn Waugh's autobiography, letter V, which I discovered in Balliol Professor Jasper Emeritus's delightful little and little-known book, Snobs. Some of you from 18 months ago may recognize this color as the attempt at the royal purple. UT has a copy because I bought and donated it. It's the only reason they have it. That passage from Evelyn Waugh saying that stinks and science were socially inferior persons will remind you of other things now in this talk. It's not the right attitude. Some 30 years ago, I heard a compact version from David Bright, the classics chair at Urbana, quoting one of his science department colleagues, "You've got the couth, but we've got the truth," which is a double falsehood, since there are some uncouth folks in the humanities. Most professors are deplorably non-upper class types. And the truth, whatever it might be, is not limited to the sciences. Facile disparagement of the humanities turns up even in cartoons. There are two examples on that final page. Notice the dates. It's not a recent thing. One is 81 and one is 90. A different example of the problem, also from decades ago. My UIC colleague, archaeologist Betsy Gebhard, was teaching Greek mythology, as we called it, which carried humanities credit in both nursing and engineering colleges. Some students were frustrated with the often insoluble moral perplexities. Think Oedipus, Antigone, Orestes, Medea. One of them complained, "But we're engineers and we need answers." The great and problematic works in the humanities remind us that fundamental issues of life can be intractable, and it's our responsibility as human individuals and in human societies to empathize and think before we judge and act. That kind of answer can't be found in numbers or digital bits. The challenging and subversive element from Hellenic myths, the pre-Socratics, Socrates, Diogenes, and Ovid, through Renaissance figures like Rabelais and Shakespeare, is at least as important as the finishing school idea that the humanities enshrine a closed canon of perfect works. Engineers may want answers, but the sciences and humanities do their best work by raising questions and encouraging reflection. Letter X has a tiny selection from the unending debate about this subject. Two items from Nick Kristof argue both sides. First, for science against Bush-era anti-intellectualism, then for humanities, especially philosophy, as a serious guide to life. Patricia Cohen's New York Times article 6 months ago set off a cascade of responses. If it's not too facile, I would say that the humanities and the sciences should respect each other because they need each other. Neither has a monopoly on the many ways of understanding the realities of our world and our situation within it. So finally, we arrive where we started, that letter of Tolkien with its quotation marks. We can now see why the broadened use of the word, which didn't exist until a generation or two before he was born, might have felt like a newcomer in a well-established tradition. But things have changed. In the massive history of Oxford University, issued since the 90s, letter Y, there is a 147-page chapter by Mordecai Feingold on the 17th century, and his title is simply The Humanities, no quotation marks. But of course, the phrase refers only to the 17th century meaning, the old studia humanitatis. As we exit the labyrinth, I borrow yet another folkloric motif, this time from magic travel stories, faintly paralleling an element from that favorite American film, It's a Wonderful Life, namely Zuzu's Petals. You have in your hands the evidence that our journey really did take place. But there's one more thing. We've looked at the dawn of humanity, so we should also consider the future of our species. I've put a few references at Hellenic letter omega instead of Z, because since the early days of Christianity, it symbolized the end of everything. Astronomer Phil Plait's book has 8 ways that we and all life can be annihilated. Tomorrow, in some cases. The cartoon at the bottom of the page uses one of his scenarios, one that will come true. Nick Bostrom, director of the Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford, has written on existential risks and the perils of superintelligence, encapsulated in a 2-hour documentary. By pure providence, this Scientific American issue just landed in my mailbox this week about the future, with Hillary Rosner's speculations on living much longer. Won't affect me, but maybe some of the younger folk. Philosopher Sam Scheffler is apparently the first to explore what the meaning of life would be if all humans were guaranteed to be dead in 100 years or less. More optimistic sorts have created a transhumanism movement, now known as, with my theme word, humanity plus. So barring doomsday tomorrow, my theme word has a bright future, and maybe our species does too. And yet the ancient Hellenes were still right. We are and will remain humans, not gods, and the future of humanity will require learning to live within that knowledge. Thank you for attending.